But I think that a great many people are just missing and starting to miss and starting to not care. And I think that it's more important for you to understand that it's difficult to find a good teacher. It's not easy. I'm going to begin with A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now we're in the section of magic, and we're trying to understand magic. And if you wish, you can think of psychic energy. Where does that psychic energy come from? Even the name psychic energy tells you. It comes from the psyche. Where is that psyche? Is that psyche in the brain? What part of the brain? Oh, but the brain is a part of the neural system, the cortex, and the spinal column are integrated in such a way that they cannot be separated. They cannot be separated. So that there's a very peculiar kind of a sense. The earliest form of using the term psyche, because it comes from the Greek, the image that the Greeks had in their mind of the psyche is that it is the soul. But I think you should understand that the ancient Greeks had a silent, a tacit image in their mind. They thought of it as the butterfly in the person. That when you die, that is released. If it has been oriented towards the body, as the body perishes, the soul fades. It does not fade into oblivion, but fades in an infinite regression. So that the soul, the psyche, can be brought back into vivification by offering temporarily a body. Or that essence of a body, the blood. For instance, in the Odyssey, when Odysseus is going to the underworld, Circe, who's the archetypal magician, notice that the archetypal magician is feminine. She tells him that the way to interrogate the souls of the dead, the psyches of those who have gone, is to pour out a bowl of blood, and they will come and cluster around it. Do not let them drink until they answer whatever questions you would give them. The whole ancient idea of sacrifice was to offer your blood for the departed psyches, who then are able messengers or go-betweens to talk with the spirit world for you. The cleansing of an altar in ancient times was to douse it with blood. It meant that the psyches of those powers beyond us could come back into vivification. Our whole post-World War II idea of cleanliness is that somebody's going to take Lysol and clean the blood off the altar. We miss the point entirely. It's not even intelligible to us anymore, or understandable. Now the psyche, psychic energy, then, we have come to understand over the last 3,000 years, that the psyche is an etheric double, astral double. It is us able to leave the body. Now that kind of image is a mythic image, and it's all right as far as it goes. It's very usable in a mythic horizon, but don't transpose it to consciousness. Don't carry it into your personal understanding. It's a way of talking about, on a story level, using images of what happens. But that psychic energy, when it is manifest, when it is brought out into a living form, into your life, then it becomes magic. The whole realm of magic is that realm of psychic energy being brought into play, into this world in terms of actual lives. That psychic energy, the magical power of that radiation, comes from the self, the deep self, which is mysterious enough. And because of the nature, the archetypal nature of the deep self, whatever comes from it has the comprehension of all of it. So any real magical word, or any real magical phrase, or any real magical act carries the entire power of the self. Which is why anything touched by magic has been magnetized by the self to have the very power of the self, not representing the self, but presenting the self. And I have to use a little bit of a metaphor here. It's like any magical act or word or phrase is like a little runner of the self, and it doesn't represent the self so much as is a presentational expression of the self. The full self comes through that. So that when one understands that, you don't play with magic. You don't play with psychic energy. Only a fool would play games with psychic energy, because it carries the full amperage, the full voltage of the self. It's very easy to be electrocuted, and the way one gets electrocuted by psychic energy is to become numb to reality. There's no way that on a worldly level one can understand this, and there's no way that on a mythical level that one can understand this. And there's no understanding on the magical level either. The understanding is on the symbolic level. But by the time psychic energy is operative, the one area that it cannot reflexively look back on is its own deep self origin. The only way that psychic energy can look back upon its deep self origin is to gather itself into the fullness of a person. And part of the defining characteristic of a person is that a person has gathered all their psychic energy in an independent consciousness, which allows them to, in our story, turn 360 degrees, allows them to turn back and see their own deep self. So part of the final emancipation of a person in their own right is that they understand that the psychic energy of which they are made up of has a single source within. But that again, that single source within is like a rhizome of a universal self, God, if you wish. And even though you have what in a parochial way amounts to only a part of God, you have the full power. Any part of God presents the whole amperage, the whole voltage. So that there is always a spiritual emancipation of becoming a person. It's always, though, a spiritual emancipation in terms of the actual psychic energy that you are working with. And it's actual in a pragmatic sense, it's actual in an empirical sense, but it's also exact in a scientific sense. The psychic energy can be understood to the nth degree of specificity. The mystery is not in specifying the psychic energy, but in understanding that all of it together operates in a way, in a kind of a reality which any partiality will never comprehend and never understand. So that for convenient purposes, there's a difference between a person and a part of a person which is imitating the kind of movements that a person would have. And the Greek term for that, again, because it's in the Greek language which we get our refined sense of this. The Greek term was personae, and personae is a mask. It's rare. It apparently does happen in history. I've never seen it. But apparently it does happen in history that some people are born with their psychic energy a whole, as it were. We were talking about on Thursday night from the Aitareya Upanishad that the sage Vamideva was enlightened in the womb of his mother. He was enlightened before he was born. Like a classic case in point in ancient Indian tradition. I have no doubt that the rendition is accurate. It's been checked by enough accurate and elegant yogis, as good as anything I can do. So I accept that. But the usual course is like any child learning to speak. We have to speak nonsense and gibberish first. We have to play with it and play around it. The approximations, the sketches, come before the finished product. So that in the magic realm, there is a lot of sketching, which we use the psychological term of fantasy, fantasizing. The fantasizing, if it is creative, is towards the purpose of becoming the person who we can be. If that purposefulness is taken away, then the fantasizing just spins on its own wheels and becomes negative. Note that the fantasizing in itself is not a derisive term, nor something which one seeks to get rid of. It is, in fact, fantasy is the mode of magic. And if one uses it purposefully, that fantasizing tends finally to bring structures of psychic energy together in the shape of a person, so that a person emerges. So that when one is a teacher of human beings, on a conscious level, one has to be a midwife of magic. But because most social situations exist on a mythic level, not at all on a magical level, the language is misunderstood all the time. as Korzybski used to say, the map is mistaken for the territory all the time. So that in teaching, one has to bring a person out of the social habituation which they have always lived in, and assume that that's the base upon which everyone is talking, therefore that must be the base in which this teacher is operating. One has to deliver you out of that habituated certainty into enough uncertainty to allow you to finally explore your own self, try to come to symbolic realization. And because you mistrust the content base that you were familiar with, and if the teacher is right, he stymies or she stymies your attempt to find a new content base, a new diagram, which, oh, this sounds much better than the old one. If the teacher does it right, all content avenues are stymied. None of them will do. And so you go, just like an intelligent human being would go, you go underneath all content to the structure. That's entering into the symbolic realm. Then one is dealing, as Pythagoras says, with numbers. And when you get to the mathematics, then one is able to interiorize meaning, because in considering the structure, that consideration comes into an interiority, call it the mind, if you will. And that's the language that the self can understand. And the self comes, literally becomes discovered. Uncovered would be a better word, becomes uncovered as one finally understands that the meaningful structure of everything that occurs tends to be more and more a master structure. That however many different structures one has noticed, there's a structure of structure. And slowly one is brought, or as the Greeks would say, ideas, forms. Finally, one comes to understand that there is a form of form. There's an idea of ideas. Plato calls that the good. Many people in the West call that God. It's not God, but in their way, they call that God. So that the idea of ideas becomes then the mask, the last mask of the self. And when that last persona, the form of forms, is taken off, then one has an experience, I think, that we could call God. But that experience, that personae-less experience, has a very definite nature. The nature is to express, to give out. Express is a better term than create. Create is a term in the whole ecology of imagination, and we're not dealing with imagination here at all. It's a whole different process from imagination. The term that Plotinus used is more accurate, because he understood the Greek language very well. Emanation is better. Whatever occurs from emanation is not so much made, but manifests. So in the occult tradition, always the term manifestation has been used quite accurately, although many people no longer understand why it is accurate. What is it accurate of? It's accurate of the process of emanation. And in Plotinus's Aeneids, you can find a very accurate characterization of this. It's not systematized in Plotinus. One has to wade through it for a long time. But it's there. That's the source. There were other places before Plotinus, but it was never said so, with so much felicity by Plotinus that it stuck. It was remembered. It became memorable in the way in which he gave it out. So that a manifestation is an occurrence. Just as something created is a thing, something manifested is an occurrence. In the 60s, it was rightly called, in contemporary English, a happening. It isn't a happening like a rock concert, but it's a happening in that this can be seen, this microphone can be seen as a happening. It's a manifestation. It's a thing as long as it has a natural referent, that is, in terms of metal and plastic and so forth. But it's a manifestation as soon as one understands that it's a microphone. As soon as one understands what it is for, it has not been made by nature. It has been made by a self. Now, even though there are many selves involved, it's made on that basis. It's an expressive object which is not there in a natural way, but is here in a supernatural way. It's manifesting is for a purpose which is projected out and expressed at the same time that the object is being made. Now, with a thing, with an imaginated thing, the meaning has to develop out of the use of the thing. But with a manifestation, symbolically, the purpose is there with the thing already. So that when consciousness works, consciousness expresses the purpose as well as the object, and part of the happening then is the purpose which that is for. Now, the manifestation that we're interested in is the human person. We're interested in just not only what we are, but who we are. The who part includes not only what we are, but the purpose for which we are. What is the reason? Why, okay, this is what we are, but why? And so the who is a more comprehensive term that we would use here. That the person is a who, not a what. They're not a thing, but a manifestation. A person is an occurrence. Is in fact, the human person is the archetypal occurrence of the deep self. That characteristically, when the deep self works 100%, that's what a person is. A real human person. And so in a way, the person... Now, I'm going to touch on what seems to be theological language, but I want you to know that it has nothing to do with theology. The person, in their fullness, is the word uttered by God, the God within, the self within. The full resonance of that word, then the person becomes that. Not just one person, once. But every one who comes into being, who comes into their own. And so when we're dealing with magic, I say all this so that you can understand that we're dealing with universal powers. And we're dealing with the architectural structure of ourselves. Notice that the medium of this whole process is language. The medium is language. So that if one were to characterize it briefly, magic has something to do with a kind of language. Magic has something to do with a symbolic language. And what's incredibly powerful about symbolic language is that whenever one speaks it, that is made and those purposes are put into motion. Now, it's a two-bit magician who thinks that magic makes things, or that magic makes things happen. But it's a million-dollar magician who knows that that magic language institutes real purposes along with the happenings and the things. And so one is very careful to use that kind of language. I'll just give you one example, one classic example of this. The ancient Hellenistic Jewish understanding of Genesis was that once Adam named the animals, that's what they were. They didn't change anymore. They were given that form, that shape, that life process, that purpose, and they didn't change anymore. That before they were named, they were still liable to change, to slip and slide with the ambiguities of creative process. But once they were named by a consciousness, they were that. They were not just the thing, but their whole purpose was enclosed in that, so that the names that were given were magical designations in that sense. You see. Hence, the Jewish prohibition against man naming God. Because man has tremendous power if he names God. Are you going to limit God to that? To what that name includes and specifies? Well, yes, you're going to be clever. You're going to look for a name which has tremendous unfolding and no limitations and so forth. So you're going to limit God to your idea of unlimitedness. So the prohibition against naming God goes very deep down to an understanding of magical efficacy. Don't do it, was the sum wisdom. Don't do it. Don't have the hubris to think that you can imagine a self and a purpose adequate to God's reality. So we'll come back now, and we're talking about magic. And the essence of magic, as we've been talking about, is psychic energy. The psyche's energy. And the mode in which that is malleable for us in the dimensions that we occupy is a kind of language, an efficacious language, language of the self, a symbolic language. Now, mythology is always a natural language. But magical languages are always symbolic. They're always symbolic. So that the ultimate structure of a mythology is the natural human relational pattern. The mother, the father, the son, the daughter, the sister, the brother, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins, the grandfathers, the grandmothers, the grandsons, the granddaughters, and so forth. In other words, a mythology has, as its most firm operating structure, a family tree. The family tree is the archetype structure of a mythology. The archetype structure of a magical language, of magic, is not a family tree, but what we would call a philosophical tree. It is the shape of the self translated into the symbolic metaphor of a tree. So when you people who are doing Jung's essay in alchemical studies on the philosophical tree, Jung's talking in very high magical language. Jung is not naive. He's a very, very great magician. I gave a whole series on Jung and Yeats as the great magicians of the 20th century. If I'd had time, I'd include Mr. Hall, because he's almost as adequate as Jung and Yeats. This use, when one talks of a philosophic tree instead of a family tree, the self is operating in the one, nature is operating in the other. But the purpose of symbolic operation, as one can see from what I said earlier this morning, is to see that the self is expressed fully, and that is the person. So that in alchemical language, one who has mastered the magical mode, one becomes no longer a magician. One is a magician in that mode, but having mastered that mode as a whole, one becomes an artist. And the first human artists that emerged at least 30,000 years ago were magicians of magicians. Like the magicians dealt with the realm of magic, the artists dealt with the realm of magicians. And you can see already, I think, the earliest material that we have. I guess the great example, the first time that I ever understood it accurately, was understanding that the cave of Lascaux didn't just have drawings on the cave, but that the entire cave was what has been called a Paleolithic cathedral. That all of the illustrations, all of the drawings, were all part of a single structure. And the structure performed the same function that a pyramid in Egypt performed, or a cathedral in France in the Middle Ages would have performed. It was a place which expressed the full developed self, which the person who was being initiated was brought in time after time after time until they could master the whole structure, till they could participate consciously in every aspect and finally come in someday as master of the house, as someone whose deep self had been awakened, who now is able to live there. It is a house of God, not for some transcendental white-bearded character, but for that living presence of the God within who has matured and become real. And when that person is there, that house is occupied. And to paraphrase a very wonderful teacher, God has many mansions, many different houses, ways to be, just as almost as many different houses and mansions as there are styles of human discovery. But what's essential for us to realize is that it is so easy to lose the attentive grasp of what we're talking about. The whole purpose of any yoga was always classically to become capable of, as the Sanskrit said, ekagrata, grasping a single point. Because it's only when one is brought to that capacity that one can see how that single point moves or comes into being or not. And if one can bring oneself to that power of attention, of concentration, then you have, for the first time, step 1.1 of setting up a geometry of meaning. Now, when it was spelled out in Alexandria in the 3rd century BC by Euclid, if you go to Euclid's geometry, the very first sentence defines a point. He says that a point is a location that has no dimension. It's an expression, symbolically, of the interior self. Later on, Nicholas Cusanus in the 14th century, in a supposedly mystical statement, reiterates what Euclid had said 1,700 years earlier, and everybody says, oh, wow, what a fantastic thing. He said, God is a circle whose center is everywhere. It's the same statement, only done in a different expressive form. Now, the point for us is that your attention can misinterpret very easily what we are now talking about. Any inattention that you have habitually will skew what you hear, will skew what you are able to hear, will kick in an associative imagination, and instead of understanding what is being presented, yes.
She's got a 50-minute thing.
Let's wait. I love the machines. Can you come back? That single point, which has no dimension, the interior self, can be experienced like having a kinesthetic openness of both ears. So that the traditional wisdom say was that whatever is said is heard in all four quarters of space. That the voice, which is the origin of the sound, which is in this throat, is not the fount from which the words come, but the self, which is in the teacher and is quite conscious and active, the voice is speaking from there. So there's not a neurophysiological level operative, but a deep self is operative. And if operative fully, there will be someone there. There will be a person there. Now, all of these issues together, psychic energy and magic, language and self, tradition and contemporaneous expressions of it, all of these issues were brought together again and revivified again in the 15th century. They made what we understand as the Renaissance. And the last echoing spread of the Renaissance was in England, in the city of London, in the 1590s, through the first decade of the 17th century. Roughly from 1590 to 1610, with a little overlap either way. It was the last place, it was like London was the last place that had the resonance of the full impact of every issue that had been raised. And so what was of interest at the time were how does all of this fit together and work? And the confidence was that if it works, then there will be human persons who express the allness of it, will express the working of all of it. Now, the medium is always dramatic, because the classic way by which this happened in the West was by drama. It's not this way at all in China. In the Far East, the first time that there was any kind of dramatic expression of this was in the Yuan Dynasty in China, when the Mongols came in, and the Mongols brought with them a penchant for Nestorian Christian expressions of the deep self process. The first time that you get any real great drama in China is in the Yuan, in the 13th century. It gets refined very quickly, and by the time you get to Japan with Chikamatsu, you have, or Zyami, you have incredible dramas of the self. But in the West, the way that it happened, the reason that it happened was that Greek tragedy in the person of Aeschylus was the first time that it was presented accurately, so that the entire pattern of the process came through, so that when the Renaissance rediscovered the classical world, the dialogues of Plato and the dialogues of the Hermetic manuscripts, the treatises, were what they used. But slowly that came to be focused, and by the time you get to London at this juncture of the late 16th century, it was understood that it isn't in the philosophic dialogue, but it's in the dramatic structure of tragedy and or comedy. And Shakespeare comes to express as accurately as Aeschylus or Sophocles, or even Aristophanes for that matter, the process by which a person emerges out of this brilliant melee of archetypal angles and relations and the composition of the person steps forth. A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is what we're reading now in our magic, is the first time that Shakespeare, in a competent way, is able to present exactly what he is able to understand. That is to say, what is presented in A Midsummer Night's Dream is himself, his self. The power of Romeo and Juliet is in the power of those two aspects of the character. But the power in A Midsummer Night's Dream is the fullness, like the 360-degree sphere of Shakespeare's own person. It's the place, it's the first place, where the man steps free of his time and his limitations and his place. And in it, there are marriages on many different levels. There are reunions in the fairy realm. There are royal marriages. There are two pair of lesser human marriages. This whole quaternary of the royal realm, the magical realm, and the human realm, and in a complementary pair, all of that brought together. In other words, to use a phrase that the Jungian James Kirsch used for a book on Shakespeare, Shakespeare's royal self steps free in A Midsummer Night's Dream. In order to see what kind of genius Shakespeare had, to appreciate why A Midsummer Night's Dream is so incredibly accurate as a manifestation of the deep self, we have to go to the next best thing at the time. In other words, I'm saying to you, Shakespeare in A Midsummer Night's Dream is so rare, that it was over 2,000 years since the last time anybody was able to do it this well. The next best thing to Shakespeare is Christopher Marlowe. And the first time that Christopher Marlowe, he only did it once. He was killed in a brawl over a beer bill. He had red hair and he carried a dagger since he was a teenager, and he was what we call a rough customer. The personality of Sean Penn in our time is very much like Christopher Marlowe. Very much, except that Marlowe was bigger, brawnier, and more eloquent at calling forth trouble. But Marlowe managed to write Dr. Faustus.